Well, of course, the setting was that Israel had been in captivity after some nearly 700 years being in the Promised Land. Of course, they had their civil division between the north and the south after the time of Solomon's reign. The north went into captivity by Assyria in 722 B.C. The south was subjected to Babylon in 606 B.C., and they were in bondage for 70 years. And then, just as Isaiah the prophet had prophesied, a emperor named Cyrus gave them permission to return to the Promised Land, but sadly, just a small group did, less than 50,000 of the an estimated up to 2 million Jews in Babylon, just a fraction made the return. Most of them were very comfortable now living in a pagan Gentile land. But those that came back began rebuilding the altar right away and reinstituted the sacrificial system. They had a high priest named Joshua. They had Zerubbabel, which was the governor of Judah, operating under the authority of King Cyrus. But they were about 4 years into the project when the Samaritans managed to use political means to get the construction stopped. And it didn't take long until the Israelites were happy to ignore God's work and just focus on building their own houses and the like. That's when God called these two contemporary prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to charge the people to get back to work. Haggai had a very short ministry, about 4 months. Zechariah's ministry began in the duration of Haggai's ministry and lasted a lifetime. Of course, in the last few weeks, we have been focusing on the Messiah specifically in God's promises pertaining to this promised king. We saw in chapter 9 the actual triumphal entry in prophecy. In chapter 10, we see the promise of the second advent, basically the kingdom of heaven on earth with King Messiah ruling and reigning from the throne of David. Chapter 11, we saw the prophecy of the rejection of the good shepherd for a price of 30 pieces of silver, and that money would ultimately wind up in the hands of the potter. And that is exactly what happened some 500 plus years later when Judas Iscariot had betrayed Jesus for the price of 30 pieces of silver. And of course, when he went back in and threw the silver on the temple floor, it couldn't be placed in the temple treasury because it was blood money. And they did, in fact, buy a potter's field to bury indigents. Now, today we are going to be looking forward in chapter 12 and 13. As a matter of fact, we're going to see the expression "in that day," speaking of the day of the Lord. The expression "in that day" is used only 20 times in all the Old Testament. And 20 times all in the book of Zechariah, 20 times the Old Testament, all in the book of Zechariah. And then 16 of those 20 are used in these three chapters, 12, 13, and 14. So first of all, let's define what the day of the Lord is. And let me remind you that when John was talking about being in the Spirit on the day of the Lord, he wasn't talking about praying on Sunday. He was talking about being given this revelation of the events of the day of the Lord while he was on Patmos. The day of the Lord, according to J. Vernon McGee, and according to many, including myself, I'll just quote J. Vernon McGee because you are certainly familiar with him. He's a very popular Bible teacher, still heard on bot radio and Christian radio across the country with his Through the Bible teaching. Dr. McGee's been in heaven for several decades now, but Dr. McGee defines the day of the Lord like this. The day of the Lord begins when the church leaves at the rapture and the great tribulation period begins. And then it will continue right on through the millennial kingdom to the time when all rebellion is put down and the eternal kingdom begins. So the day of the Lord is basically 1,007 years. It's the 7 years of birth pains as God establishes his kingdom of heaven on earth, and then the entirety of the 7 year millennial reign of Christ, the 1,000 year millennial reign of Christ on planet earth. So with that definition, let's pick it up in verse 1 of chapter 12. And like I said, we're going to try to get through two chapters, a lot of content, but I've still got time. I think we'll make it. The burden of the word of the Lord of Israel. saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. So the subject of what we're about to read is this masa, this burden, this judgment that God is pronouncing on the nation of Israel. And God shares his credentials to remind the hearer of his credibility to judge the people and make this judgment. He is the living God as opposed to the dead gods that are carved out of wood and stone. He is the living God. If you want to look up in the sky, you can see his work. If you want to look out upon planet Earth, you can see his work. If you want to look within, you can see his work. So he is revealing himself, giving credentials. As Psalm 19 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. But of these three proofs, these three evidences that God lays out here in this first verse, I want to draw your attention to a phrase that's made in that first definition. It says that he stretched out space. It's interesting that NASA now, and I put an article that was produced by NASA in May of 2021, says this about space. It says, time and space, according to Einstein's theories of relativity, are woven together, forming a four-dimensional fabric called space-time. The mass of Earth dimples this fabric, much like a heavy person sitting in the middle of a trampoline. Gravity, says Einstein, is simply the motion of objects following the curvaceous lines of that dimple. I'll show you a picture demonstrating that in just a moment. Space.com says this, the universe has continued expanding since it was born about 13.8 billion years ago. Now let me just say this. Of course, that 14 billion year is conjecture, and that is wrong. However, they can observe that the universe is expanding. So what do we conclude from those two statements from these purely scientific journals? Well, science says the universe is being stretched out or expanding, and science, taking into consideration four dimensions, refers to this thing called the fabric of space-time. It's defined as being like holding four corners of a sheet, an elastic sheet, and continually pulling in every direction, thus expanding it. And of course, a weighted object, as you can see in the drawing, puts a dimple in that fabric of space-time. And gravity, they say, is because of the effects of that dimple. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I can tell you what a woman is. But anyway, I'm not a scientist, but it's interesting that repeatedly in Scripture, you see the universe being referred to as unrolled like a scroll or stretched out as a fabric. Is it purely coincidence that the Bible uses these terms some 2,500 years ago, some 2,400 years before Einstein discovered this space-time relationship? Is it simply poetic license by an author named Zechariah? Or is God revealing something to us, a scientific truth that he, of course, was aware of that we didn't discover for over two millennia after the fact? Well, I think it's that, if you were to ask me. God says this, and by the way, this is one of the most dramatic prophecies. If anybody wants to question the validity of the Bible being written by God, verses 2 and 3 give you a strong argument to say that it was. I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling or a cup of intoxication unto all people round about. And when they shall be in the siege, now notice this, there's going to be another siege. Now Zechariah is back in the land. They'd been out of the land for 70 years after a siege by Babylon. Of course, Daniel was revealed a period of time called the times of the Gentiles. But the Jews are back in the land, and almost immediately God is telling them they're going to be driven back out of the land, and we see that there's going to be a coming war in the siege both against Judah and Jerusalem. Now, this term, cup of trembling, a couple of observations I want to make from that. First of all, when you see the cup of wrath or the cup of the wine of God's wrath or drink deeply of the cup from God's wrath, we see that that is both an Old Testament and New Testament figure of speech. Isaiah 51:17, I give you one example. Wake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which has drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of his fury. In Revelation, we see concerning Mystery Babylon. The great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So in one way, this cup is referencing judgment. But in another way, that term of trembling references an alcoholic, a person that's staggering because of the influence of alcohol. And this intoxication also is referencing the fact that the nations of the world are intoxicated with the idea of controlling and eliminating the city of Jerusalem. It goes on in verse 3, in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. Now, first of all, in that day. So that's the day of the Lord. But we see working up to that evidences of this truth even now, because I think we are getting close to that launch. And again, the rapture of the church will take place. There will be a peace treaty confirmed with Israel in the Middle East, and that will officially start the time clock of the 7 years that's called the time of Jacob's trouble, that will lay the ground for the birth of the nation of Israel, or the rebirth of the nation of Israel as they are spiritually alive going into the period of time called the millennial reign of Christ. But in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be destroyed, though all people of the earth be gathered together against it. Now, the idea here is having a boulder fall down a mountain and block the road that you're traveling. A stone blocking the road. Every nation wants to remove this impediment, but they are going to destroy themselves in their attempt to do so. In fact, we already read in verse 2 that the whole world is going to lay siege to Jerusalem. And here we see that all the people of the earth are going to be gathered together against Jerusalem. Now, what's interesting, that at the time Zechariah was given this prophecy, the time that he wrote this, Jerusalem was in a rubble. Jerusalem had not been rebuilt. As a matter of fact, Nehemiah won't return to begin the work on the walls and the streets of the city for another 60 years after Zechariah is writing chapter 12. And when Nehemiah comes back to do the work, he observes, he does a scouting trip around the city and confirms that the city is in fact in desolation. Nehemiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 13, we see the account of Nehemiah's inspection tour around the city. He said this, I went out by night, I viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof, which had been burnt and had been consumed by fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain and to the king's pool. And there was no place for my donkey or horse, whatever he was riding, the beast he was riding, that was under me to pass. So in other words, there was so much rubble, he had to dismount from his ride and walk to finish his task. Then went I up in the night by the brook and viewed the wall and turned back and entered by the gate of the valley and then returned. Then said I unto the others, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that there be no more a reproach. So the point I'm wanting to make here is God's telling Zechariah that in the last days, in fact, in the events leading up to the day of the Lord, and that first seven-year period, that Jerusalem would be a cup which intoxicates all the nations of the world. All the nations of the world would come together against it and eventually lay siege in their attempt to destroy it. Now, while Zechariah was writing this out, you have to look around and realize that the city of Jerusalem was already destroyed. There's nobody living there. It was a rubble. But what do we see in our day? Of course, for over 2,000 years, there was no nation of Israel. There were no Jews actually occupying their own land. Much of what we now call the Promised Land was literally a malaria-infested swamp fit for no man. But now what do we see? We see this magnificent city of Jerusalem. But even with that, it doesn't make sense. except for the United States of America, many nations around the world don't even recognize Jerusalem as the capital. They call Tel Aviv the capital. It's not on a major trade route. It's not a port city. Why in the world would God tell Zechariah to pen that this city is going to be the number one city that concerns all the nations of the world in the last days? Well, it's because God claimed that city for his own. And of course, we see in Psalm 2 that the kings of the earth shake their fists at God and say, "We will not have you to rule over us." In fact, quite frankly, as I've said in passing in past weeks, Jerusalem is the only city that the United Nations busies itself with. As a matter of fact, one of the latest hysterias is when Donald Trump issued an executive order to move the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Well, the United Nations had a fit. Well, what we're seeing is that Jerusalem is a burdensome stone for all nations, even in our day. Jerusalem is intoxicating to all the nations of the world that want to do away with it. And God continues, "In that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse." Now remember verse 2, we were told there's going to be a siege of Judah and a siege of Jerusalem with astonishment, and his rider with madness. "And I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah." In other words, I'm going to pay attention. You're going to have my undivided attention. "Of Judah, and I will smite every horse of the people with blindness." I'm currently, if you're going through your Bible reading with our church online on that Bible app, then you also are at the tail end of 2 Chronicles. And as you read some of the accounts of some of the invasions upon Israel, you will find that there have been several where God rescued them miraculously. There are several occasions, one being, for example, in the time of Judges with Gideon against the Midianites, where God confounded and confused the enemy to the point that they wind up fighting and killing each other. Israel doesn't even have to hardly raise a sword because the enemy winds up being mad and fighting each other and killing each other. Well, it's going to be much the same, God's telling us, at the Battle of Armageddon. And the governors of Judah, those that are ruling Judah. Now, you see Judah in yellow there at the bottom of the screen. Of course, Jerusalem is that star. So you see the capital city, the pride of Jerusalem, or the pride of Israel. You see Judah is the tribe within which the city of Jerusalem rests. "The governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts their God. In that day, I will make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, like a torch of fire in a sheaf. And they shall devour all the people round about, and on the right hand and on the left. And Jerusalem will be inhabited again in her own place, even in the geographical city of Jerusalem." Now, we're going to see the courage that God bestows upon Israelis in chapter 13 as they begin to fight, and in chapter 14. And we all know that a person fights harder defending his own home than he does overseas. There's just this instinctive added motivation to defend your wife and your children and your family and your own property. And we see here in verse 5 that all those that are rulers around Judah, the other cities, take pride in their capital of Jerusalem and are willing to fight to the death. That's added motivation that God gives them. And in verse 5, we see that this will, in fact, be their inspiration, fighting for their freedom, fighting to retain the city of Jerusalem. Now, one thing in passing I'll share with you is this is well known for those that are students of warfare, but Israel has a strategy called the Samson option. In other words, unlike the Holocaust, they say never again. They will never allow themselves to be conquered again, even if that means employing nuclear warfare to defend and sustain their existence. Now, of course, the funny thing is Israel has never admitted to being a nuclear nation. However, the world knows that they are a nuclear nation, even though they don't admit to being a nuclear nation. Supposedly, there are several submarines offshore in the Mediterranean that are equipped with nuclear missiles that are always on patrol, 24/7, never not on patrol. They rotate them out, obviously, and they are there just in case they have to implement the Samson strategy. And the Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem does not magnify themselves over and against Judah. Now, in this day and age, logically, the city was the fortress. It was the city that had the walls and was basically a stronghold or like a battleship on land. Normally, that was your best line of defense. The hills leading up to the walls of the city, then the walls of the city. It was almost impregnable. In fact, that's why they would lay siege to a city and just surround it and try to starve them out, because it was so hard to try to conquer a city. But it won't be the case in that day. The battle will actually first be won in the rural areas and then finish by being won in the city. Verse 8, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And he that is feeble among them at that day shall be just like David. And the house of David shall be as God. And the angel of the Lord shall go before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. So even feeble Israelis will fight, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon them just like he did on Samson. The common man will fight like David. And remember, David's legacy as a warrior, of course, it began by killing a lion and a bear and defending his father's sheep. Of course, he was exalted to stardom when he killed the giant Goliath and then used Goliath's sword to cut off his head. But the ladies in Israel would sing songs of celebration about David, even saying that Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his tens of thousands. And God is saying to Zechariah here, even the feeble, the most feeble among those in Israel at this time, will be just like David as a warrior. And their leadership, the house of David, shall be just like God in leading, and the angel of the Lord will go before them. I might bring to your attention a reminder of some of the battles that the angel of the Lord has fought and won. One being the conquest of Egypt and the Red Sea. One being the conquest of Assyria when Hezekiah was king of Israel, or king of Judah and in Jerusalem. One was Gideon when 300 defeated an army of over 100,000 Midianites. Another was Jericho when they marched around the city for 7 days and then blew the trumpet and the walls fell down. Those are some of the examples of the power that they have when they're following the angel of the Lord in battle. In verse 10, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me. Now, I'm going to pause right there, and we'll come to the rest of this. Notice the change of pronouns in these verses now. We are going to see some passages where Zechariah is taking down word for word what God is telling them. And then we see some additional commentary that Zechariah is adding. It's all sanctioned by God, but you'll notice a change of pronoun as we go through this. But the spirit of grace and supplications will be poured out upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem by God. Now, let's look at some other books of prophecy that talk about this day. Joel chapter 2. Verses 28 through 32. And it shall come to pass afterward, that'd be almost like saying in that day, that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. And also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. And I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. And the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before that great and terrible day of the Lord come. Now remember, the day of the Lord is 1,007 years. The first 7 years are going to be ugly. The last part of that 7 years, there will be supernatural, not just natural disasters, but supernatural judgments poured out on planet Earth, just as God did on Egypt over 2,000 years ago. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be saved or delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord has said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. We see Jeremiah also talks about this day. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, even though I was a faithful husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will write my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. So instead of having it engraved on tablets of stone, I'm going to write it on your hearts, and they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. Ezekiel comments on this same new birth for Israel. And I will take you from among the Gentile nations and gather you out of all countries and will bring you into your own land, the promised land. And I will sprinkle clean water upon you, and you shall be clean from all your filthiness and from all your idols. I will cleanse you. Who's doing the cleansing? God is providing the cleansing agent. A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away that stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a living heart. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them. And you shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers, and you shall be my people, and I will be your God. Again, that is the literal land of Israel. And I will also save you from all your uncleannesses. And I will call for the corn and will increase it and will lay no famine on you. I will multiply the fruit of the tree and the increase of the field. And you shall receive no more reproach of famine among the Gentiles. Then you shall remember your own evil ways and your doings that were not good. And you will hate yourselves for your disobedience, for your iniquities and for your abominations. Not for your sakes am I doing this, God says. Be it known unto you, and be ashamed and confounded because of your own wicked ways, O house of Israel. But thus saith the Lord, in that day that I have cleansed you from all iniquities, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities and wastes that shall be builded. So this will be a miraculous day, a day that Paul talks about in Romans 9, 10, and 11, where the house of Israel will have a Damascus road of experience and will see the Messiah and know who he is and cry out to him for salvation. But again, back in verses 10 and 11, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. Let me ask you a question. When was God put to death? When was God pierced through? This is one verse, along with Daniel 9, along with Isaiah 53, and many others, that should take a Orthodox Jew by the collar and shake him awake when he recognizes what the prophets are saying. They shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. So here's Zechariah commenting. They are going to mourn for him as one mourneth. If he had only one son and that son died, to manage the grief that you would experience. And in that day there should be a great mourning even in Jerusalem, just as they did when good King Josiah was killed in the valley of Megiddo and the whole city, the whole territory, the whole country mourned because of it. There's going to be a day, which we will see in detail in chapter 14, and we're leading up to it now, where all the nations of the world are going to come together against Jerusalem. And it looks like they are going to be successful. It looks like Jerusalem will finally fall. As a matter of fact, we're going to see next week that half the city will be under the control of the enemy invaders, and the houses destroyed, and the women raped and mistreated. And at that point in time, the Israelites are going to cry out to their Messiah, and he's going to show up standing on the Mount of Olives at the same place, I believe, where he left planet Earth from 2,000 years ago after his 40 days of teaching the disciples in his glorified body. And the first thing they're going to do when they recognize that their Messiah actually came to save them is to celebrate and rejoice over the appearance of their promised Messiah finally arriving. Then they're going to inspect him a little closer. We're going to talk about that inspection in the next chapter, which we're about to get into. And when they recognize who it is, there's going to be great mourning, every person individually. And you know how that is. You generally do a pretty good job of keeping control of your emotions when you're in public. But when you're by yourself, when you're apart from everyone else, that's when your emotions can really come out. And if led to do so, have a good cry and be in great despair. That's what's going to be described here. And the land shall mourn, every family apart, and the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart, and the family of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, and the family of the house of Levi apart, and their wives apart, and the family of Shimei apart, and their wives apart, and all the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart. Do you get the message? Chapter 13, verse 1, and in that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. Now recognize that symbolically, in fact, this is the reason we have baptism. It is a symbolic testimony of a new birth, of a new relationship, of a new beginning. And also it gives the illusion or the picture of a cleansing agent. As you're dipping yourself into water and coming up out of the water, you see an actual Jewish mikvah on the left that goes back to actually the time of Christ. And then on the right, you see a laver or a fountain that actually sits just outside the Wailing Wall. If you go down this way and turn right, that is the ramp leading down to the Wailing Wall. But you are the Jews, especially, in fact, all tourists, everyone, they've got paper kippahs there to show proper respect. You're supposed to, if you're a man, have a head covering on. So either you have your own kippah. By the way, Itamar bought me a Chicago Bears kippah years ago, so I come ready to go. Or if you are just a tourist, they have paper kippahs for you to put on your head as you go down towards the Wailing Wall. But Jews will wash as a sign of ceremonial cleansing as they make that approach. But this isn't just a pool of water. Is there a difference between a pool of water and a spring fountain that continues to flow and flow and flow and never run out? Absolutely. That's the point that's being made here. In that day, there shall be a fountain. What's the old hymn? There was a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. That's what we're talking about here. Paul references this in Romans 11. I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, this previously unrevealed truth, talking about the church, the age of the church, lest you should be wise in your own conceits. But currently, blindness, there's a partial blindness happening to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. I believe that is this age in which we are in. I believe at the rapture of the church, then God will begin dealing again through Israel. And at that point in time, all Israel, all remaining Israel, we'll see, shall be saved. As it is written, there shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. Now in these remaining verses, verses 2 through 9, they're focusing on the end of the great tribulation. And we're focusing on two parts. So this is the time when the king shows up and begins to set up his kingdom, those last days of the tribulation. First part, verses 2 through 5, is dealing with idolatry that will be rampant again during the reign of Antichrist. And then the second part, verses 6 through 9, dealing with the return of the Good Shepherd. Now, folks, Israel was driven off into captivity in 606 because of idol worship. That is one of the main reasons. They learned their lessons. After they returned from Babylon, both biblically and historically, they never fell into the trap of worshiping graven images, worshiping idols again. However, they will in the time of the tribulation. In fact, the whole world will be tempted to worship idols again. Well, why is that? Well, first of all, Jesus tells us in the Olivet Discourse that in that period of time, many shall come in my name saying, I am the Messiah, and they'll deceive many. And there shall be many false prophets that rise, and many will be deceived. Revelation 13, we have some more details. And they worshiped the dragon, that's Satan, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the Antichrist, saying, who is like unto him? Who is able to make war with him? And there shall be given him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him for 3.5 years. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme God's name and God's tabernacle and those that dwell in heaven. Verse 13. And the false prophet, which is the one writing, he's the Tonto to Kemosabe. He's the Tonto to Kemosabe. Anybody remembers the old, golly, I don't even remember the name of him. What was it? Thank you, the Lone Ranger. I kept thinking Will Rogers. I knew that wasn't right. I was going to say howdy doody next. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire cometh down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast. Dan was talking about this recently as a study through Daniel. Believe that Nebuchadnezzar is a type of Antichrist, and his image is a type representing this which will happen during the tribulation. Make an image of the beast which have the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Boy, we could spend all night talking about that verse, which we don't have time to do. But the point I'm wanting to make is this is idolatry. There will be false prophets again promoting idol worship during that last 7-year period. And that's what will be cleansed, talking about here verses 2 through 5. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith Jehovah Sabaoth, the Lord of armies, that I will cut off the names of the idols from out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And also I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesied. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophets shall be ashamed, every one of his vision, when he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. And putting on that rough garment, beginning with Elijah, was a sign of a prophet in the wilderness, enduring hardships and speaking the word of God. And he shall say, he will deny that he's a prophet. He'll say, no, I'm not a prophet. I'm a farmer, for man hath taught me to keep cattle from my youth. Now, idolatry will come again during the time of great tribulation. And idolatry will be obliterated once again by the seed of David, by King Jesus, when he comes to rule and reign. But as we look at verses 3 through 5, remember what the penalty for being a false prophet was. The book of Deuteronomy, if there is a false prophet among you, or if there is one that's trying to lead the people astray, lead them to worship idols, even if it's a family member, that person is to be put to death. Because God is trying to protect the body. And Israel is a body. And if you allow idolatry in, it's like a cancer, that if it's left alone, it will spread and kill the body. That's why these penalties in the law were so harsh. But at this period of time, again, they will be called to do the same. And these false prophets will actually try to conceal their identity. That's what's being talked about. There will be a great revival. just like in the days of good King Josiah, when he went through the land and destroyed all the false images and the Asherah poles and killed all the false prophets. That same thing, the Bible tells us, or infers it at least, is going to happen again during the time of great tribulation, as we read in Revelation 13 as well as some other passages. Verse 6 is a verse that's debatable. I don't have a debate in it, but I'm going to tell you the two possible interpretations. And one shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thine hands? And then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Now, verse 6 sits there. Now, this is going to sound redundant. Right between verses 1 through 5 and right between and verses 7 through 9. Well, now you've learned something. Verse 6 sits between verses 5 and verses 7. There are some that try to tie it to the first five verses dealing with false prophets and saying that this isn't properly translated. It's not meaning between the two or within your hands, these wounds in your hands. What it's meaning is between your arms. And it's talking about being run through with a sword. Well, I don't agree with that. This is not an issue which would cause a person to be saved or not saved. This is just an honest disagreement that some good Bible teachers have. It's not worth fighting in the parking lot over, certainly. But I am absolutely convinced that it's properly interpreted. As a matter of fact, the word for hands literally means hands everywhere it's used in the New in the Old Testament, in Hebrew. What are these wounds? So it's not the effects of a sword being run through you for a false prophet, because quite frankly, that wasn't, according to the law, the judgment for a false prophet. A false prophet was supposed to be stoned to death. One that tried to lead others into idolatry was supposed to be stoned to death. That was the electric chair in Israel. That was their means of capital punishment. So if it's not that, then what is this? Well, recognize that the evening after the resurrection, Jesus appeared to the disciples in the upper room, but one of them was missing. You remember, they were trying to figure out what was going on. They had the door locked. They had the piano pushed up against the door, and they were all cowered together there behind that. Next thing you know, Jesus was in their midst. You know, I get a funny picture of this. I can imagine them all there bundled up, shaking and quivering with fear, and all of a sudden, Jesus is there with them going, what are we doing, guys? And they were just absolutely startled when they found Jesus there in his glorified body. And of course, Thomas missed it. Thomas showed up later and they said, Thomas, the Messiah showed up in his body. I mean, his actual flesh and bone. He was here. Well, Thomas, one of the disciples called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. And the other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But Thomas said, yeah, right. Unless I need evidence, except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails and put my finger into the print of the nails and thrust my hand into his side. Remember where he had been pierced with the centurion's spear and out came blood and water. Unless I can put my fingers into the nail holes in his hands and the spear hole in his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days, again, his disciples were in the upper room. This time, Thomas was with them. And then came Jesus, the doors being shut. Again, that's an important point of emphasis there. They didn't have to open the door. Jesus was able just to come through in his glorified body into their presence. And the first thing he said was, Shalom be unto you. Well, what proof was Thomas looking for? Thomas said, unless I see the imprint of where the spear went into his side and the nail imprints in his hands, that's the evidence that I'm looking for, and then I'm going to believe. Of course, we know that Jesus appeared, Thomas hit his knees and cried out, my Lord and my God. I think that is a microcosm of what will happen at Armageddon. They did look at the, what was the evidence in chapter 13? Looking for the piercing of the hands. What was the evidence in chapter 12? Looking for where he had been pierced through in his side. Those are the evidences that Thomas demanded to be seen. And I, again, think that Armageddon, when the Messiah shows up and they look upon him And immediately they're going to celebrate and say the Messiah is here. Then they're going to look a little closer and they're going to recognize the scars in his side and in his hands. And just like the Apostle Paul when he was Saul on the road to Damascus, just like Thomas here in the upper room, the lights are going to come on in that moment. And all of Israel that has survived the 7 years of tribulation, that has rejected the mark of the beast, that has fought courageously to the end in this final battle, when they cry out to Jesus, or when they cry out to their Messiah, and the Messiah shows up and rescues them, and they first celebrate, then they look a little closer and recognize that what exactly who it was, this is Jesus of Nazareth that they rejected 2,000 years ago. It's going to be that that causes them to go into great mourning, separated from one another, as they realize what happened and why they've experienced such hardships these last 2,000 years. Now, there are some that say, wait a second, it wasn't the Jews that did this to Jesus. It wasn't the house of his friends. By the way, that was terminology. Abraham was called the friend of God. So I believe that the house of Abraham would be the house of Israel. But it was the Jews that were responsible for this. The Romans actually carried out the execution. But you remember Pilate? Pilate didn't want to execute him. Pilate's wife said, you know, stay away from this guy. You know, Pilate said, I have examined him. I find no fault in this man. Pilate stood up there and showed him Barabbas and Jesus. Said, hey, it's a custom. I'm going to release one of these two unto you. Should I release Barabbas, this known murderer, or Jesus, your king? And they cried out, crucify Jesus, release Barabbas. They have no king but Jesus. So Pilate executed Jesus in order to keep a riot from happening. That was the worst thing that could happen for Pilate, who was the governor of Judah. He was there to keep the peace for Caesar. And if he didn't, then it would be his job and ultimately his head. So the Jews were responsible. Now we cruise in here to our finish. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd. Now that term, and against the man, speaking of his humanity, that is my fellow. That word fellow is amit. Am is the name for man. And then the eat is emphasizing their closeness as a near kinsman or a colleague or a friend or a fellow, a member of an organization. Amit also can be used as a term for limitless or infinite. I believe what's being defined here is the humanity of the Good Shepherd and the deity, as God calls him my fellow, the deity of the Good Shepherd. Smite the shepherd. We saw that in the last couple of studies. And the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn my hand again unto the little ones. So when they killed Jesus 2,000 years ago, this was actually fulfilled. Jesus said unto him, put away, Peter, sword, put your sword back in its sheath. Don't you know that I can call down 12 legions of angels if I wanted to escape right now? How then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that thus it must be? And in that same hour said Jesus to the multitudes, are you come out against a thief with swords and staves for to take me? I sat daily with you teaching in the temple, and no one laid a hand on me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. And they were, in fact, their king was to be their shepherd. They rejected their king, which was King Jesus. So for the last 2,000 years, they have been a shepherdless people. But their king is coming again. By the way, a cross-reference here. When Ahab went off into battle and was killed, that same terminology was used about King Ahab. The prophecy about Ahab's death, and I did see all Israel scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. So the death of the king results in a group of people referenced as sheep without a shepherd. That was what was being talked about with Jesus when he was crucified. Israel was sheep without a shepherd. Final two verses. These are amazing. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, that two parts thereof shall be cut off and die, but one third shall remain. And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. And they shall call on my name, and I will hear them. And I will say, it is my people. And they shall say, the Lord is my God. You'll see that exact terminology used back in Exodus. You'll see that same terminology used, we just read a moment ago, in Jeremiah 31:31. But before they recognized their Messiah, before the king who they rejected, resulting in them being a people without a shepherd, sheep without a shepherd, before they have their Messiah back on the throne, and they are his people, and he is their God, they're going to go through this tribulation. Jesus described it in the Olivet Discourse as a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. Now, the world's seen some pretty cataclysmic judgments. In fact, the Jews, during the period of World War II, they say that 1 in 3 Jews died worldwide. Well, Zechariah is told to prophesy that during that final 7 years, 2/3 of the Jews in the land of Israel will be killed during that 7-year period. Now, we'll pick up next week with chapter 14. I wanted to get 2 chapters together tonight because we have an Awana graduation coming up, and I wanted to finish this study on time because we want to do that new study on biblical citizenship to go through the summer. So I wanted to rush, and these were 2 short chapters, but my, were they full. Chapter 12 and 13, we see this evidence of who Jesus was. The imprint in his side and the imprints in his hands revealing that Jesus of Nazareth, crucified 2,000 years ago, is coming again and will one day be received, and the nation of Israel will believe in a day. Just as the Apostle Paul on the road to Damascus, they will see him, they will recognize the scars, they will weep for what they have done, but they will celebrate as they enter into the kingdom of heaven on earth.